Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. Today, we will discuss Native American citizenship under the U.S. Constitution as it relates to the Trump administration's questioning about Native American birthright. My guests today are Professor Harold Prince, a native of the Netherlands. He's a distinguished professor of anthropology and an emeritus at Kansas State University, and has worked with Wabanaki people for many years. He's a regular guest on our show. We also have an expert on constitutional law, and we are eager to hear her perspective on the issue. Professor Rebecca Sosi is of Yaqui descendancy and is a faculty member of the Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program at the University of Arizona. And she is widely known for her work in the fields of federal Indian law and Indigenous peoples' human rights. She has published widely on sovereignty, self-determination, cultural pluralism, environmental policy, and cultural rights. She teaches in the areas of federal Indian law, property constitutional law, critical race theory, and cultural resources law. She is a member of the Arizona Bar Association and the California Bar Association. Professor Sosi serves as a Supreme Court Justice for the Fort McDowell Yavapai Nation and as an Associate Judge on the San Carlos Tribal Court of Appeals. Welcome to the show. Okay, so I'm going to start out by reading an article that I came across on the internet on Salon. It was a newsletter and was written on January 23rd, 2025. And it's entitled, Excluding Indians, Trump Administration Questions Native Americans' Birthright Citizenship in Court. So that's been a topic across Indian country about this citizenship. So I thought my show today would be about sort of unpacking that. And I have Rebecca Sosi, who's a constitutional attorney, one of her many, many talents, who's here, and Harold Prince is here as well. And I thought we could talk about, have a discussion about the citizenship issues. So I'm going to read this article so you'll understand where I'm coming from. So it says, again, it says, excluding Indians, Trump administration questions Native Americans' birthright citizenship in court. The Trump admin is leaning on a pre-14th Amendment law in its fight to redefine birthright citizenship. In the Trump administration's arguments defending his order to suspend birthright citizenship, the Justice Department called into question the citizenship of Native Americans born in the United States under the 14th Amendment, citing 19th century law that excluded Native Americans from birthright citizenship. In a case on Trump's birthright citizenship executive order coming out of Washington, Justice Department attorneys quote the 14th Amendment, which reads that, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. End of quote, and hang one of their arguments on the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And there's an end of quote to that paragraph. And then we start again. Under the plain terms of the clause, birth in the United States does not by itself entitle a person to citizenship. The person must also be subject to jurisdiction of the United States, the filing reads. The Justice Department then goes on to cite the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which predates the 14th Amendment by 2 years. The Justice Department attorneys specifically cite a section of the act that notes that, quote, all persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power, excluding Indians not taxed, are hereby declared to be citizens of the United States, end of quote. The Trump administration then goes on to argue that the 14th Amendment is language. The phrase, quote, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, end of quote, is best understood to, quote, exclude the same individuals who were excluded by the act, i.e. those who are subject to any foreign power and Indians not taxed, end of quote. The Justice Department attorneys returned to the topic of whether or not Native Americans should be entitled to birthright citizenship later in their arguments, citing a Supreme Court case, Elk v. Wilkins, in which the court decided that because members of the Indian tribes owe immediate allegiance to their tribes, they are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States and are not constitutionally entitled to citizenship. The United States' connection with the children of illegal aliens and temporary visitors is weaker than its connection with members of the Indian tribes. If the latter link is insufficient for birthright citizenship, the former certainly is, the Trump administration argued. Rebecca, comments?
Thank you so much for reading that powerful set of thoughts, which I think has confused many people across the country. And so I really appreciate that you're making the time and space to be reflective both about the current day and the historical circumstances that that article alludes to. So let me offer a few thoughts, and then, you know, I can answer any follow-ups that you might have. But one of the things that I think people are very confused about today is why American Indian and Alaska Native people would not be United States citizens, because they really were here when the United States was formed. They're here by birth. Their people have been here since time immemorial. They didn't come from anywhere else. So why wouldn't they be natural born citizens of the United States? And it seems really insulting to go back and reflect on whether they would qualify for citizenship under the rules that the United States has established. So when I talk to my students or audiences, I say, well, American Indian and Alaska Native people technically aren't constitutional citizens of the United States. They pre-existed the United States as nations. If you look at the treaties of indigenous nations with Great Britain, they had an identity prior to the formation of the United States. And so they were and are in many ways today more like a foreign nation, because they already had a nationality and an identity upon territories, ancestral territories and cultures and languages that go along with that. And that is the status of a people under international law. A people is on a territory and has the political ability to deal with other nations, as the all of the indigenous nations that signed treaties with Great Britain did. When the United States was formed, the United States signed treaties with many indigenous nations, and in those treaties acknowledged them as being their own separate power and authority, their own government, and promising them that the United States would not interfere with their political identity on their territory. So, you know, in the first treaties, you know, the United States said, all we want is military alliance with you and the right to pass over your territory. We don't want anything else from you. So that was the understanding when the United States was formed and when the Constitution was ratified and adopted. It basically says, for purposes of apportionment in the representative government that would become the United States, these are the classes of persons. So you have free persons, and that we know from the 1790 Naturalization Act that Europeans could be naturalized to U.S. citizenship because they were free and white. Other persons, meaning African slaves, because that is built into the Constitution, although the term slave isn't explicitly used, but other persons are three-fifths for purposes of apportionment. And that clause altogether excludes Indians not taxed because they were members of their own nation that are now surrounded by the lands of the United States, but they're not accountable to the United States as citizens of the United States. And that was in the original Constitution. The 14th Amendment was enacted in 1868. The 13th Amendment that abolished slavery had been enacted in 1865. And the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery, but it doesn't grant citizenship. And the historical antecedent to that, and please forgive me if I'm you know, going in too much detail here, but the historical antecedent for that is a case that most Americans don't really understand, or they think it is the most abominable opinion ever written. And that was the infamous Dred Scott versus Sanford case prior to the Civil War, 1857, in which the Supreme Court invalidated the Missouri Compromise that basically said Missouri could come in as a slaveholding state out of the territory of Louisiana, but the other states could have their rules that they were free states, right? Illinois and all of those free states. So the problem that you had at that time was that the free states admitted black males to citizenship in their state and on the same terms, so they could participate, you know, in many ways in the public life of the state. But the court says in Dred Scott that just because you're a free person with a state citizenship identity that was granted to you by one of those free states does not mean that the African American can claim a status as a citizen of the United States, of we the people. The constitutional citizenship is denied to African descended people, the court said, because they don't have the character of being a citizen of the United States. And it was a very racialized hierarchy of inferiority and all of these stereotypical traits that were ascribed to why it was okay to have people as three-fifths of a person. So that's something that Americans don't want. And they think the 13th Amendment basically got rid of that, which in a sense it did, right? Because you can't have slaves. But if you look and see, well, what's going to happen to those people when they're freed, the freed men question after the 13th Amendment, because you had people that the Southern states, they didn't want to admit them to state citizenship, right? I mean, they didn't want equal citizenship at all. So that civil rights law that you cited in that article, the Civil Rights Act of 1866, was the statute that basically said African-American people are citizens of the United States. They're federal citizens, and they're citizens of the state where they reside, which is the premise of equal citizenship in the United States. And that's what gives you the privileges and immunities of a citizen, where you could be born in one state and then you move to another state, but you still have all of those privileges and immunities. But the 14th Amendment is different. The 14th Amendment, 1868, is designed to make the states extend the protection of their laws to African Americans. And it only says all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state where they reside, and then has all of the clauses that go with the rights that are extended to that. Then it has a section two, because they had to change the representative and apportionment clause of the original Constitution to encompass a whole person being black. But that clause says counting the whole number of persons in each state and excluding Indians not taxed. 1868, Indigenous nations are still in their national identity. In fact, many nations like the Cherokee Nation, the Muscogee Creek Nation, they sided with the states in the American South, the rebellious states. They actually held black slaves themselves. So, of course, they didn't want to become part of the United States in this. So that clause also applies to exclude Native people from the constitutional citizenship that is extended by virtue of the action of the 13th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act of 1866. So Indians are not part of that. 1924, Congress enacted the Indian Citizenship Act, basically saying, as of now and forever into the future, future generations, American Indians and Alaska Natives are citizens of the United States, and that doesn't abrogate their treaty rights. They still have their treaty rights as a nation, but they're all American Indians. But the central distinction was back to that infamous Red Scott case, where the court actually distinguished African Americans from Native Americans and said Native Americans are free peoples and they can be naturalized to citizenship if Congress extends that opportunity and the Indian person detribalizes and consents to that citizenship. But that actually was effectuated broadly in 1924.
So, Rebecca, I have a But when was the Dred Scott, what year was that decision?
1857.
1857. And you said that nullified the Missouri Compromise?
Yes. So when the United States annexed the Louisiana Territory into this country, the question was whether or not they were, it was possible for some states to disclaim slavery, right, to be free states. And Missouri was the state that wanted to be a slave state, but there were already divisions in the state. So they enacted this compromise so that the states could, in fact, choose. And it made things a little bit difficult to enforce in terms of like the fugitive slave clause and things of that nature. So that case was about whether or not it was constitutional for Congress to do this. And the court said it wasn't constitutional because slaves are chattel, their property. And this took away the value of that institution. So that was something that they felt was unconstitutional under the existing original constitution, which actually affirms slavery.
Harold?
Yeah, thank you for inviting Rebecca and me for this show to discuss another watershed. We are experiencing a lot of watersheds in the last few weeks. This is one of those statements that I'm not sure what to make of it, in the sense of whether this is simply a nuisance snowball or whether it has any substance to it. Let's assume it has substance to it. I'm referring to Trump's statement. I was struck by the fact that the second most powerful person in this country at this moment is a South African-born guy who has dual citizenship with both Canada and the United States. Canadian citizenship he has because his mother is Canadian and he was born in Pretoria in South Africa. And that the president himself, by my counting, has had at least two wives, perhaps three, with whom he has issue. The first one was a Czech citizen, and the second one, perhaps if Marla Maples has a citizenship, was married, I'm not sure, but she was, of course, American. But the last one, the current first lady, is Slovenian born and also has a child with him, with her. So if you then think about that, the ownership of the most powerful medium empire in this country that may has ever existed is Rupert Murdoch, an Australian-born man who has assumed citizenship in this country, realize that, and this is just the very beginning of my counting, but a lot of people in the circle around and inside the White House around Trump are of national backgrounds that are different from the United States. have no deep American ancestry. His own grandfather, if I'm not mistaken, was an immigrant from Germany. So if I think about the, to use the Jewish term, the chutzpah with which this has been forwarded is just mind-boggling, because the knowledge that these people have of American history is obviously extraordinarily shallow. That's not surprising, because only when you have very little knowledge about the complexities of the past, as Rebecca just was indicating, she's just referring here to the 200-page opinion here, you would not even come up with this stuff. But since they have come up with it, we are forced to deal with a stream of nonsense that is so blatantly ignorant of A, American history, and B, of the complexities of Indian country. And I just would refer to one point here, that the conflation of all American Indians in the United States as if they're all in one rubric, that's of course false. You have the tribes that were outside of the boundaries of the 13 original colonies, as opposed to those who were inside the 13 original colonies when the country declared independence in 1776. So their status is very different. And then within these 13 original colonies, you have the groups that had already recognized tribal status and those who did not have federally recognized tribal status. I'm thinking here about the Wampanoag, all of whom have acquired federal recognition, as you know, pretty much since the famous Maine Indian Land Claim Settlement Act of 1980. There was a whole string of federal recognition cases that came through in New England. And currently we have, for example, the Lumbee case. That's a completely different case too. But even if you think about west of the Mississippi, the status of Hopi and the Pueblo nations is very different from those of the Osage and the Lakota, Apache, and so forth, because there is no treaty, as far as I know, that was concluded with the Hopi. That was a very different set of legal rights that the Hopi operate on under than, let's say, the Lakota, where you had these formal treaties. So the conflation, that's basically what I'm saying, the conflation of the complex political legal histories of all these different entities collectively under the heading of Native Americans, that's somehow misunderstood. And I don't want to get into the complexities of the recognition when I'm hearing it, when Donna, when you were reading here about the tribes that are not, quote, subject to this jurisdiction of the United States or subject to any foreign power, you realize, A, what is that foreign power? Is that Russia? That's, or is that China? No, of course not. So the not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, that bypasses the whole phenomena of the internal sovereignty. That means that since the 1830s, when the so-called five civilized tribes were contesting what ended up in the Trail of Tears, that their status was identified as domestic dependent nations. And to just wrap it up, what I'm saying here is that there's a reason why Trump likes the Jackson painting above his head, who Jackson famously said, of course, about the Supreme Court, that if the Supreme Court had that opinion, let them enforce it. So this exact same attitude about the arrogance of power and the bypassing of anything constitutionally embedded in the United States as a republic is completely irrelevant to this man.
So, Rebecca, any comments on that?
Oh, that was great. And I so much appreciate the way that you framed that, Harold. That concept of domestic dependent nation is the key concept here. So they're, you know, Native nations that are federally recognized by the U.S. government as nations are sovereign governments in the sense that they're domestic, they're part of the United States, they're incorporated territorially into the United States, but they're incorporated as political dependents, right? And that's the essence of the trust responsibility that the U.S. government has toward federally recognized tribal governments. So it's a very distinctive status. And in the Cherokee cases that Harold referenced, that actually is a really good example, because before the opinion in Worcester versus Georgia, where, you know, Marshall said that the state had no business extending its law into the Cherokee of the into the land of the Cherokee Nation, even over a non-Indian who was there. He basically said, you know, there are domestic dependent nations governed solely under the law of the U.S. and their own tribal laws. And so anybody who goes into their territory has to deal with them. But before that case, there was a prior case, Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, where the Cherokees were trying to get standing to bring the treaty violations of Georgia into federal court. And they basically sued, saying, you know, we're like a foreign nation. We have a treaty. None of us are citizens of the United States. We're only citizens of our own nation with this treaty relationship. If we were a foreign nation, we could get into court on a state violating the treaty. But the court in that case said, no, they don't have the standing. So that argument didn't work because they were a domestic dependent nation. So they didn't have the standing to sue in the Supreme Court. So that's a very good example of how the history validated that identity that was essentially like a foreign nation without giving the same standing or set of rights that would be extended to a foreign nation, but was a very ambiguous status. Actually, there have been five different frames of citizenship for American Indian peoples since the founding of the nation of the United States.
And what were they, those five?
So the original distinction was that they were citizens of their own tribal nation and not of the United States, and that's why the original Constitution had that clause in it about representation. The second part was that they were wards of the federal government, so that dependent status turned into a wardship, which was very disabling. And so people that have seen the film, Killers of the Flower Moon, I think it was called, about the Osage, that would be the ward, right? You had to ask the superintendent to leave the reservation or to buy goods or any of that. You didn't have the rights actually do any of those things by yourself. And the third frame was really that idea that, you know, they would be citizens of the United States, and that was the 1924 Act, but states still didn't want to admit them to citizenship in many places because they didn't want them to have voting rights in the state. So the fourth frame was really the U.S. Civil Rights Act 1964 and the Voting Rights Act 1965, which gave them certain protections so that they would be treated as equal citizens in state services and things of that nature, even though they would still had that federal trust relationship. So that was a hard battle for voting rights. And then the era that we're in now is really the era of self-determination, or it has been, because there is a human right to the identity of what it means to be an Indigenous people under international human rights law. And that is a relationship with the land over time, and the ability to self-govern and have your own institutions, tribal colleges, tribal court systems. So that's the era that we have been in. I don't know the extent to which the current administration appreciates those different distinctions, but that is something that always has to be considered.
So I'm thinking that we're in very treacherous waters here when we have an administration who does not understand these frames and thinks that they can just do away with anything but with an executive order. It gets kind of dangerous.
Right? Yeah, it's very dangerous, because one thing that the Constitution did do, and it's widely cited for this throughout the world, is that it did set up the separation of powers, knowing that many countries flounder because they really don't have adequate checks and balances. So the original Constitution has very delineated lines for executive authority, congressional authority, but in the current day, there's nothing to stop a president from issuing executive orders as, sort of the monarchs used to do in terms of what their will was. I want this, I want that. But they always have to be consistent with the United States Constitution, and that's the territory that we're in right now.
Okay, Harold.
Yeah, it's a there's no question that although the founding fathers were aware of having gone through the liberation struggle of the United States against a monarchy, were aware of the potential of tyrannical power by a monarch. So my point is here that the founding fathers were aware of the potential of a strong man to come to the fore and grab the power and turn into a tyrant. And so the real fear on my part is, at what point does a party, because what we basically have now is a party supported move toward a dictatorship of one. And that party, of course, is the Republican Party. That's unrecognizable to my wife's family, who historically were all Republicans. They would not recognize the Republican Party. And to tell the honest truth, when I look at Senator Susan Collins, for example, who I've worked with since the 1980s on the federal recognition of the Mi'kmaq, when she was an assistant to Senator Cohen, that kind of Republican Party that she was once part of, that has so radically changed that I am absolutely baffled how this wonderful woman from Aroostook County, the daughter of a potato farmer and the daughter of a World War II veteran who fought in the Battle of the Bulge, that I'm just absolutely baffled about the way people like her are aiding and abetting in the gutting of the American Republic. And that's actually happening, and it's going faster than anyone had foreseen, but it will have consequences unless and until the Republican Party itself realizes that one man has taken over that party and that they have all become, there's no other words for it, cowards without any spine. It's just amazing that they actually call themselves Americans. I find that utterly un-American. And I say that as a foreigner, I would never have believed, having lived in a dictatorship in Argentina, when I came back, I said to Bunny, who I was dating at the time, and saw the American flag, and said, "What a beautiful flag." And she said, "What are you talking about?" And having just come out of Argentina, I said, "What I just witnessed in Argentina during the so-called Dirty War, that could never happen in the United States." And that faith that I had in 1980, 81, I no longer have.
Well, I think a lot of people feel the same way. This has happened just so quickly, and so many things are happening. But Rebecca, I did want to ask you a legal question, another one. In this, the piece that I read when we first started, they mention a Supreme Court case, Elk v. Wilkins.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me what that was about and why they think that's relevant?
So that was a case out of the sort of the late 19th century. It was after, it was certainly after the 14th Amendment. But in that case, it was a kind of an accommodations case about, in a voting case about whether or not this American Indian individual had the right to vote. So he had moved off of the reservation and, given up his tribal relations in the informal sense. And he was living in the city and doing all these things. And so he wanted equal access in that sense, but he wasn't naturalized to citizenship because there wasn't any statute that had done that. So he argued that he was a natural born citizen under the 14th Amendment, and that, of course, he had those rights. But the court said no, because the 14th Amendment had that same clause that basically parses out Indians not taxed who are considered to be part of their actual tribal nation. So you have to have naturalization by the federal government in order to do that. And that wasn't available to him at that particular point in time. So again, that case stands for the proposition that American Indian people are not constitutional citizens, but they can be naturalized to citizenship if there is a specific act. There were other acts at that time where Congress selectively naturalized Indians. Some of those, tribes that basically dissolved their tribe and they took individual shares of land and they became citizens of the United States, the citizen band of that particular nation. They had that identity, right? Because that was a way to get some people to give up their lands in lieu of removal or something like that. So L.V. Wilkins is an important precedent on this issue.
So,
But it doesn't reach the issue that this administration seems very concerned about. So that's what I want to clarify, that everything that we've been talking about, which is very complicated, is rooted in a very complex history where different generations work through what the relationship of American Indian nations was with the United States, and that affected the rights of individual tribal members.
This Citizenship Act of 1924, does that preempts this other stuff?
So in that statute, yes, for all American Indian people, Alaska Native people, and what Harold said is very important, because I want to put this in a way that is graceful. Today, like a lot of my students say, well, what is a federally recognized tribe? And they look up the list that is published by the Department of Interior. If you're on the list, you're a tribe. And if you're not on the list, you're not a tribe. Well, the historical antecedent for that is the concept of a people. Like the Dakota people had seven different council fires, right? And now there are several federally recognized tribal governments that descend from the historic people. But that's why the international human rights law concept of the right of a people to autonomy, to speak their language, to live on their territory, to have relations with other peoples, that is the central idea that we're talking about in the modern era. But this frame of citizenship, U.S. political identity, well, so what if they don't have federal recognition? Maybe we don't have to deal with them as indigenous people. No, human rights law says no, they still have a central political status under international law. The 1924 Act was important because it broadly naturalized all members of Indian tribes, wherever they were situated, naturalized them to federal citizenship. And by virtue of the civil rights laws, equal state citizenship was conferred. Now, one of the doors that can open in a negative way from the conversation that we're having, and I want to be clear that this should not happen, but some people are misreading. So if you decided that there was a distinctive meaning to U.S. citizenship, and it entailed that you were born to parents who are U.S. citizens, for example. And Albert Hale said this, the late Albert Hale, who was the president of the Navajo Nation and an Arizona state legislature after his presidency. Arizona enacted its own birthright citizenship bill. around the time of SB 1070. And it basically said, if you're not born to U.S. citizens, then you're not a citizen of the state of Arizona. We decide who's a citizen of Arizona. And Albert Hale said, well, my parents were born before the 1924 Indian Citizenship Act, so they're not citizens of the U.S. Does that mean that I'm not a citizen of the U.S.? And the remedy in that particular bill was that the person would be deported. And so he says, well, where am I going to be deported to? We've always lived on the Navajo Nation or Diné people. Where are we going to be deported to? So I think people had to reflect a little bit. And of course, that was invalidated, so it didn't pass into final law. But that's what we're talking about here. Do we really want to set up a society with all these bizarre rules that we're reading from particular strands or sentences and attaching meaning to? I don't think so.
I agree. Carol?
Yeah, one of the things that Rebecca was just mentioning, and I just pick out one word and has come back several times, is the word complex. The complexity is mind-boggling, to tell you the honest truth, not just if you look at it from an anthropological or historical point of view, but in particular from a legal point of view. And Rebecca knows that better than most other people, including legal scholars. But one of the things that adds to the complexity is why that 1924 Indian Citizenship Act came into being. And it's important to realize that this is one of these impacts that war has made. We see that with World War II, gave a huge impetus to the struggle for native rights, but so did World War I. There was a heavy involvement of American Indians from, in particular from west of the Mississippi, who fought very heroically overseas in World War I, and returned home in 1919 after having served in occupation duties in Germany and in the border areas. But they came back and were in that kind of state of limbo, having just served in the United States Army with great distinction in many cases, and then came back into this legal status of non-citizenship. And so that was one of the factors. But what's interesting now is that not everyone in Indian country welcomed the Indian Citizenship Act, and some actually rejected it. And I'm thinking here specifically of the Haudenosaunee, the Six Nations of Iroquois, where a number of conservative Iroquoian political leaders felt it was a threat, that it is Indian Citizenship Act was a threat to their own sovereignty. And for that reason, when World War II broke out, some of these tribal leaders actually issued their own declaration of war against Germany and Japan, which is very interesting. In other words, they insisted that not just as a formality, but as an assertion of their sovereign status. I'm kind of curious what Rebecca thinks of that.
Well, Harold, I appreciate you putting that historical note about why that 1924 Indian citizenship was enacted. And you framed that beautifully and much better than I could have. There was a moral obligation. These men had fought for the country and they viewed themselves as defenders of the United States as a democratic country that embraced them. And yet they didn't embrace them when they came back. So that was, you know, a hard moment, I think, for the United States. The authority of Congress to extend this law, and this, I believe, may capture part of what the Haudenosaunee people, although I certainly haven't asked them this, and so I'm not speaking for them or anything like that. But I think that some people were concerned because naturalization in the United States works by virtue of authorization from the country and consent of the person who's naturalized to citizenship. So you're not supposed to naturalize people who don't consent. And yet that's how this worked. So it didn't matter that the individual consented or didn't consent. And the Haudenosaunee people, because they're trans border in their territorial identity, they predate the US and Canada in that sense. I don't think they wanted to be lumped into the national part of that citizenship. So it was very important for them to issue their own passports. And from what you're saying, maybe even to have a declaration of their relationship to whatever the foreign country was at issue in the war. So I wasn't aware of that, and that's important. But that part gets lost on the U.S.-Canada border and on the U.S.-Mexico border. There are really very different regimes for looking at the transnational identity of the original people who straddle those lines. And that can be very difficult. Canada, for example, their Supreme Court basically said that if you were a descendant of the people on the Canadian side, but you had an American citizenship identity, you were still eligible to exercise Aboriginal hunting rights on the Canadian side. So the Canadian Supreme Court said you're a citizen of the land in a sense over time in history. And so, yes, that Aboriginal rights doctrine extends to you regardless of U.S.-Canada citizenship, but the U.S. does not take a similar position.
That is actually very fascinating what you're saying, because the Wabanaki here in Maine, of course, have dealt with the Jay Treaty, which is the border issue, and that's been historic. Lately, you don't hear that much about it anymore, but it was very active in the 70s and the 80s that Donna remembers well, because it was the recognition that the Mi'kmaq and Maliseet on the other side of the what we sometimes refer to as the medicine line, right, the international border that was slicing through the ancestral homelands of the peoples who are in the border areas, that the United States, by virtue of the Jay Treaty, recognized, although it had to be reasserted in a number of law cases, the right for indigenous peoples on the other side of the border to cross into this country and work, for example, like in the case of the Mi'kmaq and Maliseet, work in the blueberry harvest of Washington County and the potato harvest in Aroostook County. There was this free border crossing right that was suddenly stopped, and that went to court after a series of border protests, in particular by Passamaquoddy at the border crossing near Calais.
I've actually written this in some work and would love to, you know, share that with you at a later time. But I do think that the indigenous peoples of those territories need to state the context of any of those pre-existing international agreements like the Jay Treaty, because they are deeply rooted in the history of those peoples and territories. So whatever you have to offer, I think would be so important, whether this, you know, is the right time or not, but that's very important to me.
Yeah. Well, that was a while back, Harold, and I, quite frankly, I can't really remember.
Yeah, well, I don't want to switch this discussion to that domain, but Rebecca, I will get back to you on that and to Donna about the Jay Treaty. But the Jay Treaty, because I worked with the Mi'kmaq for 10 years on federal recognition and land claims in northern Maine, we were dealing all the time with a very complicated political issue because of that international border. The Jay Treaty was just fundamental to the existence and recognition of the Mi'kmaq on this side of the border as a federally recognized tribe since 1991. But we have quite a lot of stuff, so we can get that to you.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Sure, I couldn't help you.
No, don't worry. I think a lot of these issues may come up in the future. You know, so it's just great to have this framework.
But one quick issue, again, back to Rebecca. And again, Donna does know this stuff. She's just kind of humble and shy here, I'm sure, at this moment. But the fact is that what is, you mentioned Canada before, Rebecca. But as you know, the status Indians versus non-status Indians, and one factor was marriage. that if a native, full-blood native woman in Canada historically married a non-Indian person, she would lose her Indian status in Canada, and vice versa, a non-native person marrying a Native American, Canadian Indian man would acquire status. So you see that whole issue on the Canadian side in terms of who is and who is not an Indian by federal recognition status in Canada is so radically different than on this side of the border that while the status, the Indian Status Act has been changed in the Indian Act, that nevertheless it had huge ramifications. Give you one particular example. I remember coming to one of the Mi'kmaq reserves in First Nation reserves in Nova Scotia, and there was this woman from my homeland who had married a Canadian Indian soldier who she fell in love with in 1944 and then followed him as a war bride. And she actually was elected to the tribal council of her First Nation reserve because she was, according to the Canadian law, she had Indian status. And then, of course, Native women who had married a white man lost it, but even after their divorce, could not get it back. So the Canadian side,
wow.
So weird history, if you will, with respect to Indian status.
Oh, that is very interesting. Wow. So a non-Native person could become one with the status of an Indian up there,
yeah,
under that particular rule, whereas,
yeah,
an actual tribal member could lose that if they married the wrong person. Wow.
There was a famous case of a Maliseet woman from Tobique, Linda Lovelace. Donna may remember the name, but she brought that case to court at the time. And so there's a lot of these very fascinating issues that, as we already have indicated earlier, how that makes it really complicated to understand issues of sovereignty and self-government and self-determination when you have a tribal identity, who is a member, who's not a member, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You
absolutely.
Get the citizenship stuff thrown in on top of all that. So it's makes it very complicated. But then you kind of wonder the implications of this executive order, like if in fact they continue to say that, you know, Native people are not citizens, and, you know, start to treat, it's like what you said, Rebecca, in that other case, like, I think you said it was Arizona or someplace, that it's kind of like, well,
mm-hmm,
if we're not citizens, where are you going to put us? You know? So that's, I think,
yeah,
that's really, it's very dangerous concept to just let lie. Because Native people,
absolutely,
yeah, I mean, that it's not that it could never happen to us, for sure.
And yeah, and I think
now
that,
that,
you know,
yeah, I mean, they are
people
taking,
with them.
Yeah, so they are actually, ICE is now taking sometimes Native people into custody, not, you know, not recognizing, or not if they don't have, you know, their identifications or whatever. So that is dangerous and could get even
more. Yeah.
So.
Yes, and so I think the key distinction is that concept of a domestic dependent nation that Harold referenced earlier, that was a particular political status that was hammered out before the 14th Amendment. And everything has to kind of track that through the eras. So this juncture, the executive order should not affect any American Indian or Alaska Native people. And somebody should probably talk about the 1924 Act with the current folks, because they seem to not bring it up. You know, they're kind of going on that old language. But the idea of your parents being citizens at the time you were born, or either they revoke your citizenship, that could come into something that we don't want. Because, of course, many Native people who are born on the reservation, this was particularly true in prior generations, they don't have a birth certificate because they're born, you know, at home or in some thing. So the paperwork to prove that you are a U.S. born citizen who is a member of a tribe. I mean, that can be a construction of identity, as you just pointed out, Donna, for purposes of getting, for example, a voter ID or knowing where to reach you on the reservation. Do you have a permanent residence there or whatever? And it's that kind of a thing that could make life very difficult if the policies are implemented in a way that distorts the identity of equal citizenship that all of these generations, and certainly Congress in the 1924 Act, ought to secure for American Indian people.
Right. Harold, last word?
Just briefly, coming back to Rebecca's earlier statement about she was concerned about the profound lack of understanding about citizenship for Native people, and also the tendency to draw Native rights into the attack on DEI and special status. One of the things that I found striking about this whole show, because that's maybe all it really is, because this man lives in front of his TV and seems to be all kind of, you know, hard to distinguish between what is show and what's real, because in many ways we live in a reality where show is real. But I was thinking about the dual citizenship that, just give an example, the estimate, although the Israeli government doesn't keep track, there are 200,000 Israelis with American citizenship, dual citizenship. So what you then get is, in terms of subject to and foreign power, what do you do with these 200,000 Israelis, for example? Many well-known professors here at the American universities, musicians, actors, business people, who have dual citizenship, and that's not just Israel. Many countries have it, including Australia, for example. Rupert Murdoch has given it up because he was a media power, and therefore were certain kind of rules in which it was better for him to give up his Australian citizenship. But there's no other rule that would have prevented him from keeping it. So I don't know how many millions, if there are 200,000 Israelis with dual citizenship in the United States, and three of the hostages, as you know, that were just released by the Hamas in Gaza, three of them had American citizenship. Many of the settlers in the West Bank have American citizenship as well. But then I'm not counting even the British, the French. I don't know which other countries allow it. But you start talking about millions and millions of Americans who have that subject to a foreign power component by virtue of the fact that they have dual citizenship, dual or sometimes triple citizenship, including many millionaires who are buying themselves citizenship in the Caribbean islands for tax purposes.
Wow. Great point. Very powerful point.
Last comment, Rebecca?
I just appreciate this time with you, Donna. I appreciate you always looking at these issues and making them accessible for the folks who listen to your program. And you just are so important to all of us. So thank you so much.
I'd like to thank our guests, Professors Rebecca Sozzi and Professor Harold Prince. Thank you all for listening to Wabanaki Windows. And the music for our show is by Rolf Richter, CD Dreamwalk, track called Little Eagles. Tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.